This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, is here to explicate something that Gregory taught me very early on in our conversations many years ago. China, the People's Republic of China, cannot feed itself. In addition, China's water is bad and not going to improve any time imaginable. Those two facts, added to the difficulties of maintaining security in the highlands of Tibet, where the water comes from, add up to a nation that is vulnerable to large change, and I mean more than revolution. I mean anarchy and shadows. However, I don't want to write a novel here. I want to understand where we are in this cycle. Gregory, the Chinese miracle since the Deng Xiaoping, who was a brute, but a brute who embraced capitalism, we thought at the time. But if I read you correctly, capitalism was not what we were witnessing. We're witnessing a game in where they're going to entice money from outside and paper over, cover up, ignore that they can't feed themselves. How does it go, Gregory?
Well, it wasn't just a matter of food, although it started out that way with Deng Xiaoping's liberalization, where he allowed people to grow food in their private plots of land in the country and even in suburban areas to alleviate the major food problem, which China had then and, of course, continues to have. And that started, if you like, the economic revolution in mainland China. And it wasn't that Deng Xiaoping consciously embraced capitalism. He started to see that it alleviated huge amounts of problems. Firstly, it gave people a sense of freedom and identity to be able to grow their own food and to trade that, and then to start the trade in small manufacturers and the like, and really, again, give people a sense of purpose and a sense of control over their lives. And Deng Xiaoping basically then formulated it into the policy, basically saying it doesn't matter what color the cat is as long as it kills rats. In other words, we can call anything communism if we like. And so that worked extremely well. The net result of that was a more formalized structure to allow foreign capital to enter the country and to, if you like, make sure that through the manufacture of goods which had originally been manufactured in Europe or the United States to occur in China and to be exported back to the European and Western markets. So that worked very well, built up a huge flow of cash into the PRC. PRC became wealthy. It still hadn't worked out all of the modalities of a market economy, nor the legalities of property ownership and all those sorts of things. It was still, in a sense, the Wild West. And inevitably, the Wild West becomes more regulated by either government clampdowns or just straight bureaucracy. But by the time the Deng and the post-Deng eras had ended and Xi Jinping was elected to the leadership in 2012, what you had was a large amount of cash, but you could see that the cash inflow and growth were peaking. The problem is that nobody knew to what extent anything was going on, because every statistic that is published in the PRC is a lie. I mean, it's like, you know, if something looks good, then make it better. Or if something's bad, cover that up. So we don't really know the extent to the population levels, the actual revenue levels, and so on. You can attempt some forensic research on it, but it's inevitable that you're being misled one way or another, to the point where now Xi Jinping, who didn't care about economics, basically just went crazy with the checkbook. And in fact, instead of the little red book to win the hearts of foreigners, he used the little red checkbook, in other words, the Belt and Road Initiative, to buy favors, buy his way into markets around the world. But he didn't think it through. And the result is that the PRC has run out of cash. China's internal economic policies under Xi Jinping have also been disastrous, resulting in massive distortions in various areas of the market, whether it's in local government spending or whether it's in the building of apartment buildings and the like. And it's basically all fallen flat. And we're now at the point where not only is China unable to feed itself, still, it doesn't know where it can go. It doesn't know how to rectify the problem. The Politburo and the elders of the Communist Party in various factions basically a year or more ago told Xi Jinping he would have to focus back on the economy and investment. Xi didn't know how to do it, didn't do it. The result is that by October or so last year, the economy was increasingly in shambles, and Xi Jinping was more or less constrained by the party and his allies and supporters, his loyalists within the military and intelligence and security services were being removed from his control or basically eliminated. And right now we're in the position where Xi Jinping is a figurehead. I think the next couple of months we'll see whether he lives or dies. If he lives, it'll be as a figurehead. He's already very ill, and that's apparent from his appearance, but there's also the reports of a couple of strokes in the past year. And the question for the Communist Party now is, did they leave it too late to control him? Because right now, if she goes, so could the party, because we're now seeing a country on the verge of increasingly spontaneous outbursts of violence against the party. So it's quite conceivable that we have seen the last of Xi Jinping. In the latest report, I called him a dead man walking, and maybe the Communist Party of China, the CCP, is a dead party walking. The question we have to ask now is, during this period, while they're still walking, what damage can they do, and how will that influence the transition to a new China? We are seeing this is, if you like, the lead up under Gorbachev to the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And if Trump is to increase or continue his pressure, that will accelerate the process. Maybe if he doesn't accelerate the process, then the Communist Party might have a chance to buy some stability, crack down on the dissidents, and start to reintroduce incentives for the domestic economy as well as the international trade. But it's very unlikely. I think we are seeing terminal China at this stage. And the question is, what happens after that? Particularly in China, we'll see massive harm done to the Chinese population. There's no question about that. Already the population numbers have declined. Whether they were ever at 1.4 billion, we'll never know. But the question is, to what have they reduced so far with the epidemics, with the starvation and all kinds of mismanagement? Is the population now under a billion? Is it 800 million? We don't know. So we have to just wait and see what happens. But it's going to be very quick and very soon. And we've been warning people that this could happen. In 2007, I wrote that by about 2025, the PRC would either go through a major rebirth or it would undergo a collapse. And it's literally coming to pass, accelerated by Xi Jinping, I think.
The one detail recently in Moscow, May 9th, the parade, and she's standing next to Mr. Putin. The relationship between Moscow and Beijing has never worked since the beginning, since Stalin humiliated Mao as much as he could in that famous visit at Christmas time to Moscow. Stalin is venerated by Putin. He certainly knows the history. He certainly knows that China doesn't have any affection whatsoever for Moscow. Where is that relationship now after that a near hug in Red Square?
Well, that's all contrived and it's all theater. And by the way, I don't think Putin admires Stalin at all, one iota. I think he regards Stalin as the animal who lost the Russian Empire. That's what he decried. He decried the loss of the Soviet Empire, which was the Russian Empire. So Putin has no love for Stalin, that's for sure. But as you say, the Sino-Russian relationship has always been poor, going back to the days of the Tsars. And essentially, you've got a situation where if with the collapse of China, you'll find countries like Russia and India in particular attempting to reassert their territorial claims. The Indians want to take the Tibetan plateau and cut mainland China off from its land access to the Indian Ocean, in other words, cutting across northern Kashmir, occupied by Pakistan at the moment. Russia will try to consolidate its territories, linking with not only with North Korea, but along the Chinese border, where the Soviets, in fact, during the Second World, the Cold War, the Soviets had more divisions based on the Chinese border than they had facing NATO in the West. So it gives you an idea about the reality of Sino-Soviet, Sino-Russian relations. Russia is now at the point where it's far better off than China. It's very much self-sufficient and an exporter of food. It's an exporter of not only of oil and gas, but also of manufactured goods. It's got a pretty good position. And frankly, if I was Putin, I would want to make sure my friendships were secure in Central Asia, and my access to the Black Sea and the Indian Ocean were achieved. But I wouldn't necessarily want the empire back because it's too much to manage. And basically, he's in a good position as he is right now, provided he has develops good relations south through the Black Sea and through the Caspian to Iran and so on.
And therefore, what we're witnessing now, this so-called No Limits Partnership, is pretense on Moscow's part. Is it pretense on China's part?
I think China needs it, absolutely, but Russia doesn't need it so much. Mm. This is why I've been saying that Russia has regained the whip hand over China, whereas China, when it had so much money, and Russia, when it was still recovering, if you like, from the Soviet era, Russia needed Chinese money at that time. Now, not so much. That Russia is going well.
That foreign investment has stopped, almost entirely stopped into China. Is that a considerable factor for Xi? Does he care about foreign investment?
He never did because he never really thought this was a factor. He thought China was rich and powerful because he was the emperor, but the party thought it was important. Bear in mind that most of the party elders are in one way or another less Maoist than Xi Jinping, and they're more accustomed to the wealth which has given them vast personal fortunes, which were created from Deng Xiaoping and his successors. So Xi doesn't care about it, but the party does, and the party has basically told Xi, get your act back together and get the money back. Xi can't do it, not interested in doing, doesn't know how to do it. So essentially, his days are absolutely finished.
Kingship. We turn to kingship, Gregory's new book, Noble State. And what is it we're witnessing as the king delivers the speech in Canada? Kingship.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.